Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host the Future of Civil Rights Enforcement, the EEOC, the OFCCP, and DOJ, featuring Jenny Yang, Craig Lean, John Greenbaum, and George Lanoux. Jenny Yang has served in several prominent roles in the federal government, most recently in the Biden White House Domestic Policy Council, as Deputy Assistant to the President for Racial Justice and Equity. She's also served as Director for the OFCCP, Chair, Vice Chair, and Commissioner at the EEOC, and a Senior Trial Attorney with the DOJ Civil Rights Division. She's currently teaching employment law at New York University School of Law. Craig Lean served as director for OFCCP during the first Trump administration. He's currently a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of K&L Gates and a professor of government lawyering and professorial lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School. He is also vice chair of the District of Columbia Advisory Committee to the Commission on Civil Rights and chair of the Civil and Human Rights Committee of the Bar Association of the District of Columbia. John Greenbaum is the founder of Justice Legal Strategies. Considered one of the top civil and voting rights lawyers in the country, he has worked for over 25 years in key positions at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law and in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, where he litigated numerous important and complex civil rights cases. George Lanoux is Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Professor Emeritus of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He has also taught at the American University, Columbia University, the University of Chicago, and the University of Miami. He's the author of 5 books and dozens of articles. For 30 years, he was Director of the Project on Civil Rights and Public Contracts at UMBC. Our moderator for this program is Bob Gaglione. Bob is an arbiter for the American Arbitration Association. He also teaches law and politics courses at several universities in Southern California. From 2019 to 2021, he was deputy director of OFCCP. He has over 30 years of legal experience, previously working for Gaglione Law Group and McInnes Fitzgerald Rees and Sharkey. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to get to as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Mr. Gaglione, thank you for joining us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone joining the program today, live on December 18th, 2024, and to all of you who watch this or listen to it in the future. A very special thank you to our colleagues and friends around the country who are with us for this important discussion on the future of civil rights enforcement at the EEOC, OFCCP, and DOJ. We have a lot to talk about with our outstanding panel today, so let's get right to it. I'm going to ask each of our panelists to tell us a little bit more about their experience and background in the field of civil rights and equal employment opportunity, or EEO, enforcement. And also some of our panelists will be asked to discuss a little bit about one of the agencies that they worked at in the past. We'll start first with Jenny Yang, who's worked at all 3 of the agencies. Please tell us a little bit about your experience with civil rights enforcement and also a little bit about the EEOC and how it enforces civil rights.
Well, thanks so much, Bob, for having me join you, and to Craig for inviting me today. I do care deeply about these 3 agencies, having had the chance to serve first at DOJ, then EEOC, and most recently at the Department of Labor as the director of OFCCP. And I wanted to start, I will tell you some more about EEOC and its structure, but I wanted to share briefly why I've made advancing equal opportunity my life's work. I grew up in suburban New Jersey in the 70s as one of very few people of color in our community, and that has shaped my experience. My parents immigrated from China. My father was a professor who came to America for graduate school. My mother came to the country in second grade when my grandfather came to teach aeronautical engineering nearby here at the University of Maryland. And my mother was a dietitian originally, but as a young child, when I was a young child, she shared with me experience of discrimination that she faced at work. And I saw that impact her self-worth and her dignity. And one day I wrote an essay about discrimination. I came home and I told her about this, thinking she would be proud of me, that I was talking about something important that she had taught me about. And instead, she was horrified. And she was like, "Oh, did you use the word racism?" And I said, "No, I think I just said bias and discrimination." And I didn't understand why she was upset. But she explained she thought people might think badly of our family that we were talking about this. So from a very early age, I learned that discrimination could affect people to their core, but that somehow we weren't supposed to talk about it. She later went to law school. She became a judge on the Workers' Compensation Court, appointed by a Republican governor. So we had a bipartisan household. But what I learned from her was that it is really, she eventually spoke out about it, ended up, you know, in the papers accidentally talking about the discrimination. But people came up to her afterwards and said that she helped change things for them and that they thought they got opportunities they wouldn't have if she hadn't spoken out. And so that's why I have made this my life's work. And 60 years ago, our country came together on a bipartisan basis to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that created the EEOC to enforce Title VII. And in fact, 82% of Republicans voted to pass the Civil Rights Act that time. And the beauty of our anti-discrimination laws is they protect everyone. And not everyone is aware of that. I learned that when I was at the EEOC. But I do believe that fairness and equal opportunity for all are fundamental American values. The EEOC is a 5-member bipartisan commission. Members must be confirmed by the Senate, and the president designates the chair. And Title VII provides that no more than 3 members can be of the same party. Currently, we have 1 Republican commissioner, Andrea Lucas, and 3 Democratic members. Charlotte Burroughs is the chair. Each term sort of ends in July of each year. Andrea Lucas's term will end this July 2025, and then each of the Democrats' terms follow 1 year after. Keith Sonderling finished up his service. He was the other Republican. His term ended this past July. One thing that has changed under the Trump administration, under the chair, Janet Dillon, was that now any litigation requires a commission vote by the Senate-confirmed commissioners. So you would need at least 3 votes for any litigation. 25 years ago, the commission delegated a good amount of that authority to the general counsel and reserved the vote for cases that were more controversial or larger in size and budget. So that is one shift where now it remains the practice or the requirement that the commission vote to approve litigation. The commission also votes to approve any guidance documents. And the general counsel serves a 4-year term. The commission term is 5 years. And the general counsel makes recommendations. The commission is charged with the litigation. Typically, with a new administration, the general counsel will change. The president has not, in the past, asked members to leave of the other party. That is the way the tradition and practice has always been at EEOC. And there, we can talk more. I know we'll talk more about some of the transition issues, but those are the basic structure. The agency itself has tended to be more, you know, independent of the administration changes because that is how it's structured on a bipartisan basis. So throughout different changes in administration, the agency has continued to bring important anti-discrimination cases. Thank you.
Thank you. And Craig Lean, why don't you tell us about yourself and a little bit about OFCCP and its background, please?
Sure. Such an honor to be here. Bob and I served together at OFCCP. Always good to be reunited. And Jenny was my successor at OFCCP, so it's great to see her too. And we have a really illustrious panel today. Honored to be part of it. So my involvement in civil rights came about really when I was in middle school and high school, working with other students with intellectual disabilities, predominantly Down syndrome and other medically fragile students. I used to do that in middle school and high school quite a bit. I was a Special Olympics coach. So I became very involved in the disability area. Then as a parent, you know, my first daughter, Alexandra, who's 19 now, has profound autism and intellectual disability. And my son, Pierce, who's 13, was diagnosed on the spectrum as well. On the other part of the spectrum, where you might not even be able to tell he was on the spectrum. But, you know, so I've seen both parts of the spectrum. So I got involved there with my daughter in particular, seeking supports for her through the education system and thinking about what her life would be like, the different public supports, the possibility of employment, things like that. I then became, when I was in Coral Gables, I was the city attorney, and I did a big push for the principles of inclusion, we called them, but it was to make sure that the city was including and incorporating people with disabilities, residents with disabilities, visitors, businesses owned by people with disabilities into all aspects of city services and city life. I went around and I would talk to cities about that to try to do more in the disability area. That brought me to the attention of Alex Acosta, who became Secretary of Labor. He appointed me to be OFCCP director. And in that job, one of my big focuses was Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act. So I did a huge focus on disability inclusion. And that's been a big focus of mine throughout my entire career. I care deeply about civil rights, not only in the disability area, in other areas too, but I was brought to it through my work for my daughter and then for other people similarly situated to my daughter, trying to advocate for them. I also myself self-identify as having a disability. So this has been part of my life. It's something very important to me, and it's something where we need to do more. Now, OFCCP, let me just say briefly, Jenny mentioned that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the year after President Johnson, through an executive order, 11246, as part of the same civil rights movement, the same time period, adopted the executive order I mentioned, and which led to the establishment of OFCCP. At that time, it was called OFCC. But ultimately, they added 503 and VEVRA. And so those were programs. So it became the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs and has continued in existence since that time through Republican and Democratic administrations. If you go on their website, it'll show you what each of the different administrations did. And it's been a very successful agency. I was proud to be the director of it. During my time there, we did the 503 focus. But you know, what it's probably most well known for is the audits that it does, the compliance reviews related to federal contractors. So it makes sure, the idea is that under the executive order, if you receive a federal contract, federal money, that you commit to certain affirmative action and non-discrimination obligations, many of which are also enforced by the EEOC, by the way. But OFCCP is more active in terms of reviewing that. They actually do audits of federal contractors to assess whether they are practicing equal employment opportunity, whether they have pay disparities or hiring disparities, and if so, they have them correct those. So that's an overview of OFCCP, and it's time for the next speaker. Honored to be here today.
Thank you. John Greenbaum, can you tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division?
Thanks, Bob, for having me. And thanks, Craig, for being the one who invited me. And like you, I am a parent of a child on the autism spectrum, and it's a big part of my life as he's now, we're trying to navigate the education system. He's a junior in high school now. We should talk sometime. My interest in civil rights actually comes beginning with my parents' experience. So my mom, a Japanese-American, grew up in Hawaii, Catholic. My dad, Jewish, white, grew up in Florida, and they met in California in 1966, decided to get married at a time in which interracial marriage bans, that you had some states that had bans on interracial marriage until the Supreme Court's decision in Loving the next year. And I have to say, even a lot of members on both sides of the family were not wild about my parents getting married. But me being biracial, having also mixed background in term, mixed religious background, I've always been a believer in people being able to fully exercise their rights and their opportunities in society. And so from the time I was very young, I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer. I had the fortunate opportunity when I was in my third year of practice to get a job with the Civil Rights Division at DOJ in 1997. And I did that for 7 years. And then I was at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law for 20 years, mostly as its chief counsel. And then in April, I began Justice Legal Strategies, which is a legal consulting firm that has goals to advance the progressive community. So I'm going to talk about DOJ, where, as I mentioned before, I worked for 7 years. Much of that time overlapped with Jenny. DOJ is the nation's law firm, and it has primary responsibility in most areas for litigating cases on behalf of the United States. And there are instances in which other agencies have that responsibility, including involving employment issues, where there are areas in which DOJ and the EEOC share responsibility for litigation in the employment field. There's certain certain things happen at the EEOC and not at the DOJ, and then DOJ has exclusive jurisdiction over some other things, particularly if it's a case involving alleged discrimination, employment discrimination by a governmental, state or local governmental entity. And then DOJ also works with the OFCCP, and including occasionally the OFCC referring a case to DOJ. DOJ, like with the upcoming presidency, there's going to be some changes at the top of DOJ. But the primary, almost all the employees at DOJ are career employees who serve in one of the divisions at Main Justice in DC, or they also can serve in one of the 94 U.S. Attorney's offices across the country. DOJ, on the affirmative side, when the government is the plaintiff, will primarily through the Civil Rights Division, will litigate civil rights cases. DOJ will also serve to defend the government in this area. So, for example, if there's a challenge to minority contracting program, DOJ would be representing the government on the defensive side.
Thank you very much. Professor George Lanou, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience in the civil rights space?
Well, thank you. And I'm really privileged to be a part of this panel with so many different types of experiences, and I'll enjoy listening to you. There was at the beginning a comment about family history, and I'll be very brief. My father graduated from college during the Depression and became eventually the president of his union at Lear Brothers, and then switched to administration side and integrated the Lieber Brothers plant in Los Angeles. So he took some chances for the right causes, and I've always admired him for that. My own career, I'm a professor emeritus now. I taught constitutional law for 45 years at various places. I was assistant to the executive director of EEOC, particularly when EEOC became responsible for the application of Title VII to higher education. And there were some issues there that they needed some help in thinking through. I was the Department of Labor's first expert witness on equal pay cases in universities. And I have been an expert witness in over 30 cases involving discrimination in public procurement. I have done audits on public employment and procurement systems, but perhaps the thing that my particular background will add to this panel is that I have been doing research very recently on what I consider to be a huge legal change in the way courts are viewing the use of race in various programs. I've written 4 articles, 2 of them are published. The first one is The Demise of Disparity Studies, published in Law and Liberty this November. I published a piece called Racial Preferences and Economic Benefits from Widely Accepted to Legally Indefensible for the Federalist Society Law Review. I have a new Federal Society Law Review piece coming out called The Widening Impact of SFFA. And then another piece which will be coming out titled, Did the Biden-Harris Administration Inadvertently Kill Racial Preferences? So that will be the background that I'll use to try to be a helpful commentator in this discussion.
Thank you all very much. Well, we're about a month away as we record this webinar today from an administration change from President Biden to the second President Trump administration. And I want to ask each of our speakers to comment on what they believe will be the civil rights enforcement priorities for the three agencies in the upcoming Trump administration. And also with an eye towards the impact of the Students for Fair Admissions case on what those priorities might be going forward. And so let's go back to Professor George Lanoue. We'll start with you on this question.
Well, thank you. It's not easy to predict. We will have some new leadership, and some of them are not identified yet. None of them are confirmed. We may see more of a identified conflict between equal protection and affirmative action. And there's a question of whether all equal employment enforcement will be consolidated under the new DOGE activity, which is looking to reduce federal employment and federal expenditures. There's been an important shift in the politics in this area. Republicans are more unified and vocal in opposition to preferences and to DEI. Red state AGs supported the outcome in SFFA. Blue state AGs opposed it, and the Biden administration opposed it. So there's now a very clear partisan divide on these issues. Some Democrats are rethinking their support of identity politics, but how the party will eventually come out on those kinds of issues is too soon to say. On the impact of SFFA, there are really three principles in that court case that I think will have an enormous impact on future litigation, future policy. One is that to use race, you have to use it as a remedy for constitutional and statutory violations, not just statistical disparities. Second, race cannot be used as a negative or as a stereotype, and there's a great criticism in both the majority opinion and in Justice Gorsuch's concurring opinion about the way we have traditionally clustered groups, so that groups like Asian Americans or Hispanics are now considered to be imprecise or over-inclusive in the court's decision. So these three things, finding a constitutional statutory violation, not using race as a negative or a stereotype, and not using over-inclusive, the court used the term, the group categories were imprecise, overbroad, incoherent, and arbitrary. Those are going to make a difference. So I suppose one of the things that I would be very interested in having my co-panelists comment about, but will have to be sorted out, is how are the traditional affirmative action programs consistent with SFFA if the affirmative action programs had at least a subtext of requiring proportional representation? That may be very questionable under SFFA.
Thank you. John Greenbaum, your thoughts on this issue?
Bob, and maybe I'll predominantly focus on SFFA versus Harvard and UNC because I was involved in that litigation on the side of defending those programs and representing students who were in favor of affirmative action in those two cases. I think I look at it in sort of two ways in terms of what the case actually decided and then kind of the psychological effect of the case. I think the case didn't really change the law outside of the area of college admissions, because even prior to SFFA, take employment for example, the standard was very high for employers to consider race at all in terms of the decision-making in employment, only in rare circumstances was that allowed. You have to meet the test of strict scrutiny. The college admissions, in a lot of ways, was an exception for a long time based on the Bakke case, where universities, they did have to meet a strict scrutiny standard, but universities were essentially allowed to have admissions standards that allowed race to be considered as one of many factors, as long as its overall impact was relatively limited. And SFFA versus Harvard more or less got rid of what was essentially an exception to the jurisprudence elsewhere, where and particularly in employment, where race, there were rare were the circumstances that race could be used as a factor in terms of who you were going to hire or promote or anything like that. Now, I think the perception is far different in terms of what the effect of the decision is. And part of that has been that conservative groups have been more aggressive in terms of challenging programs, a lot of which were legally vulnerable prior to SFFA, some of which weren't. But there is an overall challenge to the use of race in terms of decision making in a lot of different fields right now. Some of those cases are currently being litigated, and we'll see what the new administration, what direction it takes in terms of how active it chooses to be in those cases. Typically, the administrations have not, unless they were on the defendant side, not themselves typically been involved in a lot of the affirmative action cases.
Thank you. Craig Lean?
Yeah, so, in providing this sort of forecasting, I am just speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for the administration or anything like that. So, but I do have some thoughts. I think, one, you're going to see a much bigger focus, to some extent, again, on religion. Fighting religious discrimination, anti-Semitism, combating that, Islamophobia. So I think you're going to see a focus on religion, also religious liberty for organizations. I think that's probably going to come back as well, and religious accommodations for employees. So religion. A second area where I think you'll see a focus in civil rights is veterans. So veterans employment, veterans non-discrimination, veterans healthcare. I think that's going to be a big focus again. Third area is disability. I think you're going to see a big focus on 503 again, big focus on people with disabilities, on employing people with disabilities, non-discrimination as to disability, trying to get more resources put toward disability. EEOC has been pretty good at that. The number one complaint that's been made every year for a number of years, other than retaliation, is disability discrimination. The EEOC always reports that. But on the OFCCP side, it's been more of a challenge getting OFCCP to devote more resources to disability. Each of us here that have been involved with OFCCP have done our own efforts to try to change that. That needs to continue to change. There does need to be more of a focus on disability. So I think you'll see those three areas. I also think with OFCCP in particular, you may see a movement away from affirmative action, at least to the extent that it involves what was talked about earlier that might be inconsistent with SFFA, anything that could be viewed as a preference or a quota. Now, OFCCP has said that preferences and quotas are illegal for many years, and Title VII says they're illegal too, and the EEOC says they're illegal. But there has been a concern that sometimes when you set these goals, that companies may put their thumb down on the scale a little bit, like a plus factor or something, to try to achieve those. So, the only time really you should have a goal is when you have a statistically significant underrepresentation that's indicative of discrimination, that essentially there's a barrier to employment for those individuals. And then the only thing you can do is outreach and recruitment and eliminate that barrier. So I think that that'll be a focus. The last area I'd mention is DEIA, DEI, or whatever it's called, because different companies use different names for it. I do think that will be a focus to some extent. particularly where it relates, where there's anything that could be viewed as an exclusion. What do I mean by that? So if there's any employment programs that exclude a group based on race or gender or other protected class, even from something as simple as like a mentorship program, for example, that doesn't allow anyone to be part of it, I think that that's going to be a focus. I think that that's probably not going to be allowed anymore, you know, to be honest with you. That's what I think that that will be a focus of OFCCB. I do think equal employment opportunity programs and trainings will continue to be required and companies should do them. But so if you ask me, I would say that those are the areas where I think you'll see OFCCB and the other agencies focus.
Thank you, Craig. Jenny Yang.
Well, thanks so much. I do agree, Craig, with the areas that you have identified for focus. I think my primary worry is the politicization of the work of equal opportunity. I think that the work that these agencies are charged with enforcing is very consistent with American values of fairness and freedom from bias and equal opportunity for all that I think most people on this call agree with and most of America agrees with. So I really hope the federal government will continue to play an important role in standing up to support individuals who have faced discrimination. You know, one area where we may see a difference is in the use of the disparate impact theory. I did speak on a Federal Society panel talking about the constitutionality of the disparate impact theory in the first Trump administration. We did see, you know, regulations proposed that were attempting to walk back from disparate impact. But at the same time, the Justice Department under Trump did bring a disparate impact case challenging a tech company and alleged discriminatory algorithms. So I think there is somewhat of a debate going on about the utility of an important theory that Congress approved for Title VII that recognizes that where you may be systematically excluding individual or a group based on race or other protected bases for reasons that aren't job related, and there are other better ways to do this that don't discriminate, that companies really shouldn't be doing that. So I think there is probably some internal debate about when the use of that theory is effective. I think that has been an important part of the Title VII jurisprudence for a very long time, and I think it remains an important tool to root out a wide variety of practices that can operate to exclude people for reasons that aren't job related. I think, you know, on the SFFA question, you know, that decision has caused a lot of confusion in the employment space because it has already been the law that employers are not to consider race, gender, other protected bases as a factor in making an employment decision. There's a limited ability to use race-based affirmative action under an older line of the Weber-Johnson cases as a remedy for past discrimination or for a manifest imbalance. But the large majority of what employers do to promote equal opportunity that may fall under the umbrella of diversity, equity, inclusion is fully lawful and does not consider race in decision-making. So I really, really hope, but I am concerned about the way in which this issue has been politicized, because the work of removing barriers so everyone has an equal opportunity remains core to the work of all these agencies. And I think it's important that organizations have the freedom to use their judgment on what has worked best to fully utilize the talent across America. Thank you.
Thank you all. Just a reminder, I see there are questions coming in. We'll get to as many as we can at the end of the program. But if you have a specific speaker you want to address your question to, just mention them in your question in the Q&A box in the for those of you participating in the live webinar today. The next topic we want to talk about is the coordination of activities between the three agencies. And the EEOC, OFCCP, and Department of Justice have been coordinating more frequently their civil rights enforcement activities during the Biden administration and the prior Trump administration, as illustrated by the Memorandum of Understanding which was entered into between the three agencies, as well as the higher initiative between EEOC and OFCCP. Question for the panelists is, do you see this trend continuing in the upcoming Trump administration? Is this a good trend in your view? And where are the areas that will most likely be focused on coordination in the coming years? And to the extent you want to comment also, Craig, Lean will go first on coordinating when 42 USC Section 1981 cases are being brought in tandem with Title VII.
So yes, I think there will be more coordination. You know, there was a debate among the panel whether this was too dry a question to talk about an MOU between the three. I was a little biased because I negotiated that MOU when I was there. And so I wanted to include it, but I think there's a good reason to include it. So I just want to, it's going to get more interesting. And that is, I think because of the Jarkasi case, there's going to have to be more coordination between the three. I think OFCCP, for example, there's a real question whether they can bring administrative law judge cases anymore related to the executive order or even the other two statutes, that anything that sounds a lot like Title VII or that involves a large monetary award, which a lot of OFCCP's cases do, may need to be in front of a jury, may need to go to federal court because of Jarkasi. And even if those cases don't have to, because OFCCP has historically taken the position that those cases sound in equity, essentially, and that they're make whole relief. But even if that's true, nonetheless, I would say that the risk that you could do an ALJ case for 10 years, these cases can take a long time as they go up and down, and then have it at the end, some sort of attempt to, you know, raising the defense that you've raised the whole time, that this needed to be brought in federal court. And it finally gets up to federal court under the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, and they say, hey, this shouldn't have been brought in front of the ALJ, and you have to start all over. I think that risk is a big one for the agency. So there's going to be a strong argument that OFCCP should start bringing these cases in federal court. To do that, they're going to need to cooperate with DOJ, likely under the current regulations. Those executive order cases can be brought by DOJ. There's a precedent there's a federal district case, the Duquesne case, which was many years ago brought in federal court. Or they're going to have to work with the EEOC to bring those cases in federal court under Title VII. So however they do it, there's going to need to be more involvement among DOJ, OFCCP, and EEOC to make sure that they have a consistent approach and that these cases are being brought effectively so that they can achieve equal employment opportunity, because all three share the same mission. So my sense is you're going to see that cooperation. In the Biden administration, they often talked about the all of government approach. So in Democratic administrations, I think you see that cooperation too. And I think Jenny's going to speak to that to some extent about the higher initiative. From the Republican administrations or the Trump administration, I think there was this focus that, hey, we want DOJ and the federal courts who have the most experience with a lot of these issues, or the EEOC, which has the most experience with Title VII, to weigh in on what OFCCP is doing here. So we want all three of them to cooperate. And there's a lot to be said for that. So I think you are going to see more cooperation. I should also just, so you all know, most of the complaints OFCCP receives, they refer to the EEOC. So they already have that cooperation. They keep some cases, particularly sometimes in the veterans or disability area, but they refer a lot of cases. So that cooperation already exists, but I think you're going to see more of it. I predict that.
Thank you, Jenny Yang.
Well, thanks, Craig. So I was the one that thought, is this too weedy for folks? But I'll try to make it interesting, sharing some of my insights on the cooperation and coordination. So I tend to be a very collaborative person. So for me, it's like coordination is always a good thing. And I did see, serving in government, why silos happen. They happen for a reason, because you can move faster if people aren't blocking you with things that in your view are ancillary or oppositional. So it happens a lot in government, because the more people know, the more they can mount, and if they have a different view, they can sort of mount some opposition that could undermine you from getting it out. But fortunately for me, when I was chair of EEOC, this was second term in the Obama administration, and the Obama administration really had set the tone of agency coordination. So some on my team at EEOC said, we have been coordinating more with OFCCP over the last 4 years than we ever did in his like 30 years with the agency, or maybe it was even more than 30 years. And so what had happened before was ad hoc coordination. So in one of our field offices, there happened to be one spouse at EOC, the other at OFCCP. And so that office worked very well together. But then they got a divorce, right? And so then it didn't. And we realized like you can't rely on these ad hoc. Some offices, OSCCP and EOC, were in the same building. People go to the gym together. They'd hear about, actually, we have an overlapping case, the same exact defendant on the same issues, right? And we didn't actually realize that until later down the road, right? So we have worked a lot more closely to deconflict, to make sure that we know when we have a similar issue and where it makes sense. We may do joint investigations. I still say we, but the agencies may do a joint investigation. One might take the lead where one has language access capability, they might help the other. So I think that has been really important because there is a very shared mission between the agencies, but they have different, you know, different authorities and powers. EOC has, when I was there, 90,000 charges a year. OFCCP has the audit power and gets large data sets to understand trends. So I do think like in coordination helps everyone, including the employers. And EOC tends to issue guidance on how to interpret Title VII. They've been charged by Congress to do that. When I was director of OFCCP, we tended to follow the EOC's guidance and interpretation of law. We thought that was better for all concerned, including the regulated community, so that under the law, they had the employers had one standard to look towards. When I was at EOC, we were doing much more coordination with DOJ. Because one of the things that I saw when I was at DOJ, I was a trial attorney for 5 years, soon in, you know, early into my career, there was a long delay because DOJ only has authority over state and local governments, but EOC has the authority to investigate the charge. Where the EOC finds reasonable cause, it refers it to EOC. And what we were doing at that time is we would reinvestigate the whole case. We would interview the same people and maybe some others. We'd go out there. And so by the time we were ready to make a decision on whether to litigate, the evidence was stale. Sometimes courts would get upset. People would pass away. So it wasn't helping anybody. And so now what the agencies do is DOJ comes in much earlier and can often sit in with EOC on key witness interviews. And we only have to do it once. And then often that will save a lot of time. I agree with Craig that the DOJ can play an important role in potentially litigating OFCCP cases. When I was there, we were really excited. We almost got, when I was at DOJ, we almost got one OFCCP case, but then it was resolved. But, you know, we were very proud to say we enforced 11246, but we actually never got the opportunity to. So I think that is an underutilized authority. The other thing I will mention is that EOC also has an important role in the federal sector's own equal opportunity work. We do expect to see significant changes. We know there was a commitment in Project 2025 to eliminate DEI offices and staff within the federal government. That causes me great concern. But EOC is charged with running an administrative process where individuals have the ability to file a charge that is investigated by their agency, and EOC serves as an adjudicator in that context, but also serves as a resource to help agencies identify barriers to prevent discrimination. And EOC ultimately decides appeals on federal employee discrimination complaints and sets a body of federal sector law. So that's also important. There are some occasions where DOJ and EOC differ in the sort of Bostock litigation and litigation related to Title VII's coverage of discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. There have been occasions where EOC had a different position than the Department of Justice. And I like to say we have generally pulled the rest of the government along, both with disability as well as other areas, in establishing that across the circuits and the Supreme Court. So I do think sometimes you see some differences of opinion because DOJ is also defending the federal government when it is sued. And so there can be different concerns from DOJ's perspective than EOC. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Professor George Lanoux, your thoughts on this topic?
Well, I really appreciate my colleagues, my panelists, who know so much about how the interagency cooperation works, and I think that's fine. I want to add a rather different perspective. In the last 4 years, the real action, the center for the development of civil rights law, has not been within the federal government. The equity agenda that the Biden administration promoted has lost 9 different cases in federal courts, and DOJ did not choose to appeal. Even in a case that seemed to me as extraordinary in terms of just public relations, where the where USDA denied white farmers eligibility for disaster relief, and it was just struck down in 2024 in the Strickland case. So what has happened is not that the federal agencies are developing new civil rights law. The energy has come from a series of conservative litigating foundations that have had great success in courts. They represent clients pro bono. They have national memberships, can litigate almost anywhere in the country. And after SFFA, they are challenging preferences. They have active cases now regarding scholarships, employment, public contracting, economic benefits, land distribution, housing, and professional licensing boards. So one of the questions that I wonder about is, will the Trump administration choose to let these conservative litigating agencies carry out what is now a sympathetic agenda for Republicans? Or will the administration seek to support some of these challenges that the conservative foundations are bringing? In other words, are they going to watch this development or will they support it? But it is clear that in this new raft of cases, really energized by SFFA and touching so many areas in our society and our economy, that there are really going to be big changes.
Thank you very much. John Greenbaum, your turn.
Yeah, I'm probably like the professor where I'm not as equipped to talk about the interagency coordination as Jenny and Craig are. You know, I would just say that I agree with the professor that, yes, the conservative organizations are out there being aggressive. They've had some victories. I think there have also been situations where there's been some overreach, particularly alleging some violations of law where the plaintiffs didn't have standing to bring the case in the first place. I think it is an interesting question as to whether the federal government will start engaging in those cases, you know, particularly going back to the Department of Justice. DOJ has typically exercised its jurisdiction in a pretty conservative way in terms of if there was a statute saying that the Attorney General had authorization to bring suit, DOJ would bring suit, but largely staying out of litigating cases where that's not the case. And I'll give you a quick example from when I worked in the voting section at DOJ, is that we could bring intentional voting discrimination cases under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but we could not bring them under the 14th Amendment. It would actually be a pretty radical thing to do, because and something that neither Democratic or Republican administrations have done very much in the past, for the Department of Justice to start engaging and bringing cases in areas where there isn't specific statutory authorization from Congress saying the Attorney General has the right to bring those cases.
Thank you very much. Moving on to another question we have, what does the mission change as the federal government transitions from one administration? How does the mission change as the federal government transitions from one administration to the next? And please comment, if you will, each of the speakers on what you expect to see in the space of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, DEIA, as we transition to the next Trump administration. And one final part of this question is, during the end of the Trump administration, the president signed the executive order 13950, combating race and sex stereotyping. It didn't have much of a shelf life because President Biden rescinded that on his first day in office. Do you expect to see some form of EO 13950 back on the table again when the new administration resumes in January? I'll start with John Greenbaum.
Thanks, Bob. Elections have consequences, and DEIA is one of those areas in which the presidential election and who's in the White House probably does have some consequences in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, which generally I think of in those areas is we're no longer talking about particular programs that are geared toward, for example, hiring, I differentiate affirmative action where you're considering race in decision-making from what I consider to be DEIA, which is more, we're trying to make opportunity more available to people. And a good example of that is what Craig was talking about when he was talking about his personal experiences in terms of making Coral Gables more accessible to people with disabilities and special needs. I think those are two distinct things. And as you mentioned, Bob, near the end of the Trump administration, they issued this executive order, often called the Divisive Concepts Executive Order, saying that federal agencies and grantees of from the federal government could not teach divisive concepts in training or in any other way. And actually, even before the Biden administration rescinded that order, there was a federal court that found that portions of that executive order violated the First Amendment. Some states have passed laws similar to that executive order, and there's been a fair amount of success in terms of challenging those types of orders or statutes in states. So in all likelihood, probably EO, some version of EO 13950 comes back. I think, again, it will be challenged on the First Amendment and other grounds. And I think the plaintiffs stand a decent chance of succeeding on that. And you never know until you actually litigate the case. I think one of the unfortunate things might be that the Biden administration within the federal agencies did really encourage them to come up with diversity, equity, inclusion, and or accessibility programs. Again, none of which involved decision-making where race was a factor, but really focusing on opportunity. I think it would be a shame, but it would not be surprising if the Trump administration dismantled those efforts either in part or entirely.
Thank you, Professor George Lanoux.
I think the question is one of how diversity, equity, and inclusion are actually defined in practice. I know more about it in higher education than anywhere else. And in higher education, diversity oftentimes means counting heads, faculty, staff, students by race or ethnicity. You could count other kinds of things. You could count socioeconomic background. You could count geography. You could count ideology. You could count lots of different, human beings are diverse in lots of different ways. But the actual count, the thing that the universities cared about, was race and ethnicity. And so when candidates for jobs were asked whether they would affirm DEI, what they were actually being asked to would you affirm considering race to have proportional representation in a particular area of the university? Now, DEI doesn't have to be defined that way, but in practice it was. And I think what is going to happen is that many places will see DEI as a signal that will get them into political trouble. They'll keep doing what they're doing, but they won't use that language anymore. So what the Republican administration will do, faced with a decline in the use of that language, but the continuation of some of the practices, it's really very hard to predict. But Republicans seem now to have found that opposition to DEI is a political advantage and not a liability. And so I think we can expect to see some more actions to limit DEI, but I can't predict exactly in what form that will take.
Thank you. Jenny Yang?
You know, I will say that some of the polling right before the election showed that most Americans actually supported the concepts behind diversity, equity, inclusion. They believe in equal opportunity and non-discrimination. They don't know what DEI means. And what has come to mean to some who did know what it means is race conscious preferences. And that actually isn't the work of DEI when implemented well. So we will see whether, I would imagine, there will be some executive order similar to or going beyond the one at the end of the Trump administration on divisive diversity training. That was what my day one job was, working to undo that executive order infrastructure. I'll let Craig talk more about those investigations that were opened and then closed without any violation finding. You know, it did unite the chamber and the civil rights community because business didn't want to be handcuffed and wanted to use the policies and programs that they know work to help them succeed in their industry and that to help America be as strong as we can for our economy. You know, one of the higher initiative that Craig mentioned that OFCCP and EOC worked on together was really all about how to help companies understand how to find talent across all communities. And I had read a study by the American Enterprise Institute and Harvard Business School that didn't talk about equal opportunity at all, but it reached many of the same conclusions, that companies were missing talent because they were excluding them for reasons that weren't job related, like if you had a break in service, and some of the algorithms were doing that. So I think a lot of the practices at their core that are helpful to all companies and advancing equal opportunity, they're more fair to everyone. Like a good pay practice, job-related criteria for hiring helps everyone. And I do hope that that work will remain. The issues around minority contracting programs are also interesting because they've typically been a Republican strong point. Many minority business owners are Republicans and have looked to Republicans to support minority contracting programs. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. And I will say there have been a lot of attention to EOC commissioner charges and requests for commissioner charges by American First Legal and others. And, you know, what I will say is that, you know, in fiscal year 23, there were 35 commissioner charges filed. That's still relatively small compared to 80 some thousand charges. And those individual charges or systemic charges that are filed, the EOC is required to investigate those by statute. It is required to. Commissioner charges are optional whether to open one. And so that's why there historically have not been that many investigations opened on behalf of commissioner charges. So I know we're almost out of time, so I will turn it to Craig. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Craig, you have the last word.
Oh, well, thank you. What I would say is merit-based hiring. I think that's going to be the focus of the Trump administration. That's probably the best defense for Executive Order 11246, ultimately, in terms of economy and efficiency, in that anything that's not merit-based, but is instead affinity bias or a form of discrimination or prejudice, that's impacting the federal contractor. That's making them less efficient. That's a problem that hurts their employees too. I do think you're going to see more pro-worker agenda than maybe people think. That's what I'm sensing. A big part of President Trump's coalition were workers. So I do think you're going to see a bigger focus on workers. But my sense is the focus is going to be on discrimination itself, less so on affirmative action or DEI. I think with DEI, I could see the administration perhaps using the contractor portal, for example, to ask companies to certify whether they have programs that exclude based on race or gender. My recommendation to companies is don't exclude. Have equal opportunity programs. Have a pay equity program. Make sure you're eliminating discrimination. Do barrier analyses. Do adverse impact analyses. But in doing that, if you find discrimination against men or against white employees, just as if you find discrimination against women or Black employees or Hispanic employees or Asian employees or Native American employees, take action, correct it. 25% of OFCCP's recoveries over the past two administrations, Democratic one and a Republican one, have been in favor of white males, whites and males, believe it or not. Now, 75% are still in favor of women and minorities, and you're still more likely to see discrimination against women and minorities. But any discrimination is wrong. And I think that's the focus you're going to see in the incoming administration. No discrimination against any group. Discrimination that occurs is not merit-based hiring or merit-based promotion. Pay discrimination is wrong. I think you're going to see a very similar message to what we talked about today. But anything that even sounds like even a little bit a preference or a quota or an exclusion, I think they're going to come down strongly on that. So if I were you, I would move away from that. So, but in the end, it's still going to be, I believe, you know, again, I'm speaking for myself here, but I believe it will be an equal opportunity agenda and it will be pro-worker.
Well, thank you all very much. I'm very sorry we didn't have time for more questions. I want to thank you to our outstanding panel for a very interesting discussion today. I'm going to turn it back over to Marco Lloyd. But again, thanks to the Federalist Society for bringing us together today. And I wish you all success in the future. Thanks, Marco.
Well, I want to second the thank you for your fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.